Hi, everybody. The North Carolina Reading Service is bringing you this program, The Indie Week, The Independent, read by John Federson, to our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And we bring this particular publication to you each week. The date on this edition, November the 21st of 2024. All right, and here we go. And we can begin with some late-breaking election news. Pending a potential recount, Democratic State Representative Terrence Everett triumphs in NC Senate District 18. While he appeared to have come up short on election night, now that all votes are in, Representative Everett has bested the Republican Ashley Bryan Adams in State Senate District 18. With all provisional ballots now tallied from Wake and Granville counties, Everett leads Adams by 134 votes. Everett claimed victory on his X account Saturday afternoon. Everett said, "I am deeply humbled and incredibly grateful to the voters of District 18 for their trust and confidence. It's an honor to have earned your support, and I look forward to continuing to serve the people of NC, just in a new office, maybe not in the basement." He's referring to an incident last year in which then-House Speaker, now Congressman-elect Tim Moore, moved Everett's legislative office to a janitor's closet in the basement, after Everett asked the Wake County District Attorney's Office to investigate Moore for allegedly having an affair with a state employee. Everett, who served in the State House since 2019, has been a target of GOP for the past few election cycles. He ran for Senate District 18, representing Northern Wake and Granville counties this year, after Republicans redrew his current State House District 35. To make it much harder for a Democrat to win. Republican Mike Sheetzelt, a political newcomer, a military veteran who works as a litigation attorney, won in that House this cycle against Yvonne Hopkins, a family law attorney who owns a law practice in North Raleigh. Sheetzelt took just over 50% of the vote to Hopkins' 47%. During Everett's tenure in the State House, he has advocated for preserving access to reproductive rights, government transparency, public education, and criminal justice reform. In the past legislative session, he co-sponsored a bill to codify the reproductive freedom protections of Roe v. Wade and introduced legislation to make lawmakers' documents public record, to ensure there's a nurse in every public school, and to clarify the law around the voting rights of felons. Everett's opponent Adams, a former nurse who now runs an event planning business in Wake Forest, said on her website she would champion fiscal conservatism and the importance of strong familial bonds. She ran on a boilerplate GOP platform promoting school choice, limited government, and, quote, conservative values. There was a Libertarian candidate, Brad Hessel, also ran, winning over just 3% of the vote. The margin of votes separating Everett and Adams is narrow enough that Adams may request a recount, but it is unlikely to change the result. Everett's win leaves the Democrats one seat short of breaking the GOP supermajority in the state Senate. They've already broken the Republican supermajority in the House. Next, from Wake County, hundreds of Wake County ballots arrived too late to be counted. Red and yellow containers sat at the end edge of the Wake County Board of Elections meeting table on Wednesday as members prepared to sift through their contents as part of the painstaking work of reviewing voter information that accompanied absentee ballots. Thousands of ballots had no problems and were approved in bulk, but some arrived initially without a voter signature. Some were sent without all the witness information included. Some didn't have the proper notary seals. The board members passed from hand to hand 109 absentee ballots in their envelopes so they could review information voters had sent the county office to correct problems in order for their ballots to count. 109 ballots down. Nearly 5,000 more to go, and that was just for the Wednesday meeting that ran for more than 6 hours. On Thursday, that's today, I guess the Wake Board will consider about 6,000 provisional ballots. 99 other counties are having meetings like Wake's to decide how many of the last of the absentee and provisional ballots to count on their way to finalizing the election totals on Friday. Collectively, they are checking to determine whether votes on those ballots can be added to the totals. Everyone is interested in accuracies, but the results have personal and professional meaning for candidates who are in close races. Wake has the most voters, and according to the State Board of Elections, had the most provisional ballots to check. Between absentee and provisional ballots, Wake board members settled in for a two-day chore. Most of the work Wednesday was done in silence, with members occasionally conferring in whispers. The board chatter picked up when members were handed the stacks of absentee ballots that arrived too late to count. The legislature ended a three-day grace period for absentee ballots to arrive at Board of Election offices. That deadline is now 7:30 p.m. on Election Day. Of the 616 late ballots that the board denied, 111 were delivered the day after Election Day, 256 were delivered on November 7th, and 146 delivered on November 8th. Those are ballots that likely would have been accepted under the old law. The stacks of late arriving ballots included dozens that were sent via FedEx or USPS Express delivery, but still didn't make it in time. Several members remarked at the $34 express delivery charge voters paid only to have their ballots arrive too late. One ballot was sent by express mail on November 4th with a planned November 5 delivery. It didn't get to the board, to the office, till November 8. Voters can go to the Board of Elections voter search site to see if their ballots were accepted. The Wake meeting drew 25 onlookers who settled in for hours of mostly silent viewing. Members of voters' rights group fanned out to county elections meetings across the state this week to watch how boards are approaching their job. They've made it a point to try to attend meetings where county board members have been hostile to state instructions for ballot acceptance, and locations where the North Carolina Election Integrity Team has been active. That integrity team is connected to Cleta Mitchell, a lawyer who in 2020 tried to convince Georgia to find up enough votes for President Trump to win the state. Election Integrity Team has trained volunteers to scour voter rolls and bring challenges against individual voters. At least one person from NCEIT was at the Wake meeting. Five members of the League of Women Voters and a lawyer with the Southern Coalition of Social Justice watched the Wake board work. Marion Lewin, vice president of League of Women Voters, said the key observation from watching Wake and keeping tabs on 10 other counties is that absentee voting, quote, is a minefield. There are too many ways it could fail, she said. Most of these ballots were checked in batches of hundreds or thousands, but some received individual scrutiny. The board reviewed 381 ballots that staff had opened and resealed because the ballots were not in the envelope. Republicans have a pending lawsuit that challenges counting those ballots, but for now they can count. One of them came with an envelope that looked as if it had been chewed by a dog. Board member Greg Flynn said, "My dog did something like yesterday. Teeth marks and everything," said board chairwoman. The board counted that ballot. And another recap now specifically from the Raleigh City Council election. And IndyWeek has published 5 takeaways from this election. The Tuesday marks the last day of meetings for City Council that was led for the last 5 years by outgoing Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. Baldwin decided not to run for re-election, but on Election Day, voters largely chose to continue moving the city in the same direction that Baldwin has taken it during her tenure by embracing growth, investing in transit, and preserving parks and greenways. As the Baldwin era comes to an end, we look ahead to the new council's swearing-in on December 2nd. Here are our biggest 5 takeaways from this city council election in Raleigh. Residents are generally happy with how things are going and voted to stay the course. Since she announced her plan to run in January, Raleigh Mayor-elect Janet Cowell, who won in a landslide taking 60% of the vote, has said she feels that overall Raleigh is headed in the right direction, saying, "We have a high quality of life, vibrant and diverse neighborhoods, and residents who make this a special place to live." She noted that rapid growth has brought new opportunities and wealth, but also displacement and burden for some. And she promises to work to ensure that Raleigh is, quote, "a city that works for everyone." Before the election, we asked if Raleigh voters would choose to change or stay the course, and we seem to have had our answer. Voters connected with Cowell's message, and across the board elected incumbents in every council seat except for District A. Next, voters chose experienced candidates. It's not unrelated to being happy with the way things are going, but when they get given the chance to pick newcomers over incumbents, unlike 2 years ago when they elected 4 millennials to the city council this time. The only exception, District A, where voters unseated first-term incumbent Mary Black in favor of Mitchell Silver. But Silver, too, is an experienced candidate, a former City of Raleigh planning director for a decade, before working as New York City's Parks Commissioner. Silver has an insider's knowledge of how city government works and was even responsible for writing Raleigh's guiding documents, the Comprehensive Plan and Unified Development Ordinance that has put the city on its path for growth through 2030. At the top of the ticket, Cowell has served in government roles for most of her career. She was a Raleigh City Council member in the early 2000s before serving as a state senator and a state treasurer. Right-leaning candidates fared surprisingly well. The last time Paul Fitz, a Republican mortgage lender, officially ran for mayor, it was in 2017 against long-serving Mayor Nancy McFarlane. He took away just under 15% of the vote, about 8,000 votes, against McFarlane, who won with more than 48% of the vote, and the other Democratic challenger, Charles Francis, who netted about 37%. And in 2022, Fitz won as a write-in candidate, and he won 1.4% of mayoral votes. This year, Fitz placed second in a field of 5 candidates, winning more than 18% of the vote, or more than 40,000 votes, placing well ahead of other Democrats in the race, Terrence Ruth and Eugene Myrick, who won 11 and 6%, respectively. Ruth had placed second in a close race against Baldwin in 2022, running just 6 points behind her. It was a similar story in other races. In District A, most conservative district, Republican Whitney Hill placed second with 33% behind Silver's 40% and ahead of Mary Black's 26. Hill came in third in 2022. And in the at-large races where candidates are elected citywide, conservative, though officially unaffiliated, candidate James Bledsoe placed 3rd out of 7, winning 48,000 votes, or 14%. behind incumbents Stormy Forte and Jonathan Lambert Melton. Forte won about 29% and Melton 24%. A perennial candidate, it was Bledsoe's best ever showing. In 2022, he ran for an at-large seat and placed fifth out of seven with 12% of the vote. In 2019, at-large race, he came in last out of six candidates. Next point, Raleigh and Durham are very different cities, and their municipal elections reflect that. In Durham's municipal election last year, City Council member Nate Baker was the top vote-getter in the three-seat at-large races between six candidates, winning nearly 23% of the vote. And Baker ran a strong grassroots campaign with a deep bench of volunteers and a message about building an inclusive city with green infrastructure. In Raleigh's at-large races this year, which also featured six candidates, Raleigh Planning Commissioner Reeves Peeler ran a similar campaign to Baker's, but didn't see the same results. Peeler placed fourth, winning about 10%, and running well behind incumbents Melton and Forte. While Peeler and District A candidate Mary Black hoped to appeal to a core base of support from working-class residents, renters, and young voters, the same demographics that Baker targeted in Durham, they fell short, where Baker succeeded. Peeler told the Indy he realized during his campaign that running for office in Raleigh is fundamentally different from running for office in Durham. And he said, we have more top-end wealth in Raleigh. There's probably overall greater inequality. There's more luxury development pressure. Our zoning code paves the way for big houses to be built and small ones to get torn down faster than other places. And because of Raleigh's history as a strong economy, a state capital, lots of jobs, great schools, people move here from out of state. Does it mean young progressive candidates like Peeler, Black, and Baker will have a harder time running grassroots campaigns targeting younger working-class voters and renters in the future? That remains to be seen. And District E, finally some stability after four election cycles that saw the seat flip as many times. Incumbent council member Christina Jones defended her seat against a well-financed challenger, change manager, professional John Sequeira, but it was a tight race. Jones won with 51.5% of the vote to Sequeira's 48, a difference of just about 1,700 votes. District E is one of the city's fastest growing in Raleigh, and also one where that growth doesn't always seem to be the most productive, with teardowns of older single-family homes giving way to much larger single-family homes dominating the residential landscape. But it's also home to residents who oppose growth or density in general. In 23, homeowners in District E's wealthy Hayes-Barton neighborhood filed a lawsuit against City of Raleigh over its missing middle development policy in an effort to block the construction of new townhomes. In 2015, Bonner Gaylord, the COO of Kane Realty, won a third term in District E. In 2017, Gaylord narrowly lost to eventual Livable Raleigh co-founder Steph Mendel, who ran on an anti-development platform. In 21, a growth-friendly attorney, David Knight, unseated Mendel, and in 2022, Jones defeated Knight by running a campaign focused largely on community outreach and engagement. That strategy seems to have worked for Jones. She's one of the most visible and active district council members, even if some see her as divisive and anti-development. And just last Tuesday night, Durham residents welcomed a new county manager, and they protest a new police facility. A crowd of residents, city officials, and county staff stuffed into the Durham County Chamber Room on Tuesday. Claudia Hager was officially sworn in as the new county manager. She was promoted to that position on November 4th after the previous manager, Kimberly Sowell, resigned under mysterious circumstances following 2 months of leave. The commissioners described Hager as nurturing, competent, creative, and a team player with a high sense of integrity. Commissioner Wendy Jacobs was visibly emotional during the board's remarks. She has served on that board for 12 years, all of which have overlapped with Hager's employment with Durham County. And she said, anyone who works in the county government knows the first car to be in the parking lot and the last one to leave every night is Claudia Hager's car, and that has been for years. Hager first worked for Durham County in 1994 when she was a grad student at North Carolina State University. She became a budget analyst and budget and management services director from 97 to 2000. She returned to Durham County in that same position in 2014 and has been with the county ever since. Jacobs says Hager was the architect behind the recent education bonds and help keep the county financially stable during the COVID pandemic. Hager has stepped in as interim county manager twice in the last 4 years after the dismissal of former managers Wendell Davis and Sowell. Durham City Manager Wanda Page, Deputy Manager Bertha Winbush, and Communications Director Beverly Thompson, and Chief of Staff Carmisha Wallace all sat together in attendance to honor their friend. During a turbulent last few years, community has been even more important, Hager said. She lost her husband to colon cancer in 2018 and says the support from her network of friends and family helped her get through those difficult times. Many of her family members, including her parents and son William, attended the ceremony. The community is still in the dark about Sowell's dismissal. County officials, including some board members, have said the details behind her leave and resignations are, quote, confidential personnel information and will not be released to the public. Hager will have the responsibility of rebuilding trust within the Durham community during her tenure as the top executive. With a calm demeanor and big smile, Hager assured the audience she was prepared for whatever the job threw her way. As a nation, she said, we are facing many unknowns right now, from the economy to the recent changes in the political landscape, yet through it all, I'll say what I always say. We will get through this season, working collaboratively with an eye on the future. Following the rest of the ceremonial items, about half the room cleared out. The remaining 30 to 40 community members were there to speak in opposition to the board's proposal to build a new training facility for the Durham County Sheriff's Department on Electra Road. The project would cost roughly $16 million. Board Chair Nida Alam pulled the item in response to emails from community members who wanted more discussion around the proposal. Alam suggested the board push the item to the next available work session on January 6. County Sheriff Clarence Burkhead said his department was prepared to give updates to the proposal, but obliged the board's request to postpone. Pushing agenda items when clarification or further discussion is needed is not uncommon for city and county officials. The board prepared to move on, but the fiery group of residents insisted on being heard anyway. Residents made many of the same cases against the sheriff's facility that were made against ShotSpotter. That city and county should budget for more community-focused resources that get at the heart of issues like homelessness, food insecurity, and gun violence. One resident, who introduced themselves as Jackson, said he's concerned that youth in Durham, like his niece, are losing out on resources in favor of unnecessary funding for increased policing. Jackson said, I firmly believe the substantial investment in taxpayer money demands scrutiny. especially when our community has so many pressing needs that remain underfunded as it is. To briefly summarize, expert-led research, large-scale police training facilitation, facilities that specialize in highly militarized scenarios, often lead to increased use of force by the police officers who attend those. Elizabeth Johnson, PhD candidate at Duke University, said she interviewed over 50 officers from across the country in the past year. Many of them cited being overworked and overextended, taking on the responsibility of other positions, but equipment, as Johnson notes, was not a high priority. Johnson said police are asked to do too much. They're expected to be mental health counselors, social workers, substance abuse experts, and more, in addition to their role of solving crime. What I did not hear named as a challenge in these interviews was the lack of a multi-million-dollar training facility like the one we're discussing tonight. Johnson is a native of Atlanta, where the term cop city was first coined. And she said, I have seen the extreme pain and division suffered over a cop city in Atlanta. People have died. People have been charged with crimes as a suppression intimidation tactic, and I don't want to see Durham go through the same pain and division my hometown has gone through. Commissioner Nimishina Burns pushed back on the scrutiny levied at the Sheriff's Department, saying it is disproportionate to other departments that Burns argues also deserve public attention. Burns said, I come from a family of protest. Where I come from, it's not just about posting on the internet. It's about doing your research. I want you all to look at the hypocrisy that happens with one department and not another one. Burns says many items related to the Sheriff's Department have been pulled from the consent agenda multiple times. Y'all can come back to this at work session, but I'm going to implore you and beg you, no matter how this falls, do your research and look how elected officials are treated in this county. Well, next, two articles related to the environment. First, the Durham School of the Arts students have staged a walkout for climate action. Sarah Rodriguez announces through a megaphone, scientists have told us we have 6 years left to solve the climate crisis before it becomes irreversible. How old will you be in 6 years? Scores of her classmates sprawled on the sidewalk in front of Durham School of the Arts, do some quick mental math. 22, 21, comes the collective response. 27, one student yells, sparkling a chorus of cackles. The mood is light. But on this brisk mid-November afternoon, these futures feel fragile. The students have gathered as part of a nationwide wave of school walkouts for climate action in the wake of Donald Trump's re-election. They're holding signs that say things like, it's a tough hill, but we can climb it. And climate change is here, so are we. Rodriguez, a junior, continues, if action does not get taken, by the time we are in college, our earth will be at a place of irreversible damage. Organized by youth chapters of the Sunrise Movement, the walkout at DSA and other schools come as students grapple with the environmental implication of Trump's return to office. During his previous term, Trump withdrew the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement and rolled back numerous environmental protections. He's vowed to increase domestic oil and gas production while slashing climate spending in his next 4 years in office. But while some schools explicitly framed their protests as anti-Trump demonstrations, DSA's chapter is taking a more action-oriented approach. Rodriguez tells Indy, we're pushing for a Green New Deal for schools, which would be an eco-friendly policy throughout the school district. For our context, it was important to us to focus on action and what we can do, unless on a candidate as an individual. Students there launched the Green New Deal for Schools initiative after getting connected to the Sunrise Hub at UNC Chapel Hill. That partnership has transferred Sunrise DSA from a standard school club into something more ambitious, according to the junior Avery O'Brien, who says, "Now we're connected to the national organization, we have actual tools to push policy forward." Rodriguez adds, "Shout out to Shiva," referencing a student leader of UNC Sunrise, Shiva Rabandari, who made headlines in 2022 when he was elected to the Boise School Board as a high school student after running on a campaign centered on climate justice. Rodriguez continues, "Without him, we would still be doing like recycling and community service, which is, of course, important, but he's the one that's been getting us to do this policy orientation." In recent months, Sunrise DSA members have been making the rounds through history classes, gathering student input on environmental concerns. The five demands of their Green New Deal for Schools campaign include safe and clean buildings, a climate justice curriculum, free and healthy lunches, climate disaster plans that utilize school buildings as community-wide recovery zones, and pathways to jobs in climate-related fields. Clean and safe buildings hits especially close to home for DSA students as they contend with aging infrastructure while awaiting a new campus. Rodriguez says, "We are fortunate to have a new, safer building being built for us, but other students do not have that opportunity. Around the school district, there are broken HVAC systems, power outages, asbestos, leaking roofs." Rodriguez and O'Brien say administrators have been supportive of the work Sunrise DSA is doing. Principal Jackie Tobias worked with them to plan this walkout on short notice. Rodriguez said, "We went back and forth on doing this, so there was a little bit of last-minute planning. Our principal did a great job of working with us on that tight schedule." The 15-minute demonstration conveniently began when the bell rang for a class change at 1 p.m., so students only missed about 10 minutes of class. In an email to Indy, Tobias wrote, "I am extremely proud of our students for using their voices and knowledge to make a difference. This is precisely what we desire." While the administration's support is encouraging, students harbor no illusions about the challenges ahead. O'Brien says, "There's a high risk that it will not end well. The science can really seem overwhelming at times, but I think it would be worse to do nothing." Next, the North Carolina State students, some, have demanded accountability for PCBs found on campus. 1 year after the closure of Poe Hall at North Carolina State, students are demanding more action from the administration to address the issue of PCBs on campus, which are linked to breast cancer. PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyl, were found with levels up to 38 times greater than EPA standards at Poe Hall last December. But the university hasn't done enough to address that issue since then, say students. The Campus Community Alliance for Environmental Justice and the NCSU Grad Workers Union delivered a petition to the institution Tuesday afternoon to express continued concern over the health and well-being of campus community members. Organizers circulated a list of six demands to Chancellor Randy Woodson beginning in March, which has received 1,276 signatures to date. The demands include asking the university to identify and contact faculty, staff, and students who have had extensive exposure to PCB chemicals at Poe Hall, regardless of the current employment or student status at the university. The petition also demands that the university fully compensate all current and former PO occupants for relevant short- and long-term health screenings, as well as medical costs for those who have been diagnosed with cancer. In addition, they asked NC State to keep Paul Hall closed until it is independently confirmed the building no longer poses a danger in regard to PCBs. Upon delivering the petition to the Chancellor's office, the students are giving Woodson 30 days to meet those six requests. But Public History Master's student Celine Shea said, "We're not asking. We're demanding today." Holiday Hall, which contains the Chancellor's office, was tested for PCBs in 2023, but Woodson told WRAL in March he doesn't know why or what the results of the test revealed. Following initial remarks from speakers, a group of about 20 students marched from Poe Hall toward Holiday to deliver the petition to Woodson. Along the way, they shouted chants, asking for action. Eric Martineau, a senior studying environmental science and plant biology, said he was disappointed by the modest turnout for the event, but thinks it was a marketing issue. He said, "It's not that people don't care about this, it's people don't know that they should care." Martineau attended a meeting on Monday with about 60 people and was the only one from that group to join in delivering the petition. Upon arriving at Holiday, students found the back entrance locked. Organizers were confused. They'd gone to the building the day before at around the same time and had no issue entering. The group then circled around to the front entrance, which was also locked. Some students peered through the windows. A photographer from the technician, the student newspaper, said he could hear a police radio. At one point, NC Newsline witnessed phones held up to a basement window through the blinds, documenting the students. Maggie Thomas, Chancellor's communications specialist, told NC Newsline in an email, "Holiday Hall is locked at various times. We do have external signage with a number to call for deliveries and admittance to the building for meetings. A call was not received this afternoon, but a petition was delivered to the Chancellor's office." Unable to deliver the petition directly to Woodson or his staff, the students settled for taping it above the doors of the front entrance. The unfurled petition was 34 pages long. Marine science grad student Hua Huang said, "This has gone beyond North Carolina, who has been signing this petition, because they all know that you shouldn't have to work in and tolerate a toxic workplace." All right, this article was published on the 14th by Lena Geller. Civil rights nonprofit is suing the Durham sheriff and a judge over closed parental rights proceedings. This is a Washington, D.C.-based civil rights organization, Civil Rights Corps, CRC, filed a federal lawsuit against District Court Judge Doretta Walker and Sheriff Clarence Burkhead on Wednesday, alleging the officials have systematically blocked the organization's staff from monitoring court hearings on dependency. In these hearings, a judge may separate children from their parents or terminate parental rights. While several Durham judges preside over these dependency hearings on a rotating basis, the lawsuit singles out Doretta Walker. Elizabeth Rossi, an attorney and the director of strategic initiatives at CRC, says, "Almost every single time we've tried to observe court proceedings in Judge Walker's courtroom, we've been kicked out without any chance to explain why we're there, without any justification." According to the lawsuit, on at least seven occasions when CRC staff have shown up to observe dependency proceedings in Walker's courtroom, sheriff's deputies have escorted them out and posted closed hearing signs on the door. The organization's attempts to obtain transcripts of the orders excluding their staff have been denied, says the lawsuit. Court watching is, quote, the bread and butter investigative tactic of CRC's work, according to Rossi. The lawsuit argues that blocking public access to dependency proceedings violates the First Amendment's presumption of open courts. Rossi says we're not asking the federal court to say, as a blanket matter, the public must always be led into every single case. We're asking for a presumptive right of access that can be qualified, that can be balanced against other important interests. CRC staff began monitoring Durham courtrooms last year after learning of ongoing issues with the county's dependency court system. A 2022 report from Emancipate NC and Thrive Tribe NC described dependency proceedings as, quote, slow-moving and efficient with unrelenting continuances. Indy has also reported on cases where parents say they've been penalized by the court for speaking publicly about their cases or joining protests against DSS policies. Leading the local push for reform, Amanda Wallace, who spent a decade as a Child Protective Service investigator before founding Operation Stop CPS, a Durham organization that works with families navigating what Wallace calls the family policing system. Wallace quit her investigator job in 2020 after she was required to relocate a child she says she knew was safe at home. Quote, the majority of children coming into custody is because of poverty-related concerns. If the public just came and sat inside the courtroom, they'd see, wait, so this child was taken away because the parent didn't have child care? Can we not figure that out without giving their child to somebody else? For parents, in dependency court, Operation Stop CPS has become a source of crucial emotional support. Sharoka Pettiford discovered the organization last year after leaving a hearing feeling defeated. Pettiford, a Durham mother of seven, who has been navigating dependency court proceedings since 2019, says, I remember feeling like it was over. I had nobody else to turn to. For years, she says, she sat through hearings feeling isolated, in the lion's den, with everyone against me, even my attorney. And goes on, when my support is allowed to be there, when my community is allowed to be there, it's everything. Even though they're sitting in the audience and I'm over here with my lawyer, I still feel that support and love, and it means a lot. In proceedings over the past year, Pettiford says Walker sometimes closed the courtroom to community supporters for reasons she did not understand. The lawsuit seeks to require Walker to provide an opportunity for advocates to be heard and make, quote, specific, on-the-record reviewable findings, demonstrating that closure is essential to preserve higher values and is narrowly tailored to serve that interest, unquote, before excluding them from the courtroom. The lawsuit also seeks an injunction to stop Birkhead from enforcing what it calls unconstitutional courtroom exclusion orders. And Wallace sees the stakes in stark historical terms, saying, the courtroom is the new auction block. What they're trying to hide is the evolution of slavery. If you look back, there are pictures of the actual moment of black mothers reaching their hands out as their children are being taken away of them. If that image was happening in 2024, we would have public outrage. People would be upset. And so what they've done now is bring it into the courtroom to be able to take children away in private. Walker and Birkhead did not respond to the Indy's request for comments on the lawsuit. Over to arts and music and whatever else we can fit in our 13 minutes remaining. Triangle musicians remember Rhys McHenry as a beloved force of nature. One of this area's all-time greatest singing voices went silent on November 14th. Rhys McHenry died that morning, felled by metastatic sarcoma after years of suffering through multiple health struggles. She was 51 years old. Officially, McHenry was survived by mother, brother, and her husband of 18 years, Justin. But her family was much, much broader than that. In a way, you could list the entire local music community as survivors. Quite apart from the magic she conjured on stage, going back to her days fronting Dirty Little Heaters, McHenry was one of the most universally beloved figures on the scene. Her longtime friend and fellow musician Mimi McLaughlin from the Magnolia Collective says she was also a nanny who raised a lot of people's children, pets, homes, and broken hearts. It's hard to memorialize such a big person. She had a gigantic heart, and it was battery-operated. McHenry did indeed have a pacemaker installed to steady her heart after a series of strokes. She beat the sarcoma once, but it came roaring back with a vengeance this past summer and was too much to overcome a second time. Still, she fought it to the end, maintaining grace and good humor with a series of posts. Her final post was written on October 18th, saying, "I think I'm doing well to the point I may be able to break out the acoustic and play very gently." Her final public performances were the weekend of August 2nd and 3rd at The Cave in Chapel Hill, at which point the cancer was already taking a toll. Her husband, Justin, said she could barely walk to the car afterward, but you'd never have known it from her performances. Her husband, Justin, likened it to the finale of the baseball movie The Natural. As most people who knew Reese know, she's a bad mother. She had a biopsy wound bleeding through the dressing the second night, but in true Roy Hobbs fashion, she still played and still rocked. She's tough. She did it, somehow. Routinely compared to Janis Joplin for her powerful, bluesy yowl, McHenry was a genuine force of nature, a phrase that has come up repeatedly in the wake of her death. She played with a string of bands, her fellow garage rockers, Spider Bags among them, and never met a crowd she couldn't move. Her friend Virginia Maxine Sloop recalled seeing McHenry at the North Carolina State Fair once, in circumstances where most musicians would have been politely ignored. And Sloop says at least half the folks were there only because the chairs to sit in, gnawing on turkey legs. Curse of the daytime stage, but as soon as she started singing, they sat up and paid attention. She won over a crowd of random fairgoers. But the memories that resonate most for her friends came off stage. Artist-musician Caitlin Carey remembers McHenry taking her on a shopping trip once to buy a dress for an upcoming event. She was moved by how seriously McHenry took a mission that Carey herself had mixed feelings about, saying, "It's hard to explain why that mattered so much. It has to do with how hard it can be to put true value on your art, your life, the actions of the day. Rhys made it really matter. I suspect she did the same thing for a lot of people, particularly women, who needed to have their whatever taken seriously." Sloop remembers McHenry as one of the most genuine, real people she's ever known, without being a pushover, saying, "As kind as she wasn't overly sweet, still a smartass, and God, when she was on stage, you could not look away. For all of us, you loved her and wanted her to like you. And when she did, you were excited about it. a force of nature. How lucky we got to see and know her. It seems unreal, but it was. Now, plans for memorial services are still in the works. In the meantime, countless remembrances and tributes have been appearing on social media. A previously scheduled benefit for the McHenry family's medical bills and expenses went on at Local 506 on November 15th with Pipe, Spider Bags, Lud, and Hot Brains playing for a gathering of the faithful. Before long, there will also be a McHenry mural appearing somewhere in the triangle, painted by Scott Nurkin of the North Carolina Musicians Murals Project. Nurkin, the drummer in Dynamite Brothers and Birds of Avalon, said, "Reese would be simultaneously embarrassed and totally encouraged to hear everyone call her a force of nature, because it's such a truth. She was a musician you instantly bonded with because she was better than good. The woman could wail." We discussed her mural at length before her death, and it's going to be one of the most fun, inspiring things I've ever done. All right, and here's one I've kept aside since October the 3rd and not read, and it's still apropos about a store called Mad Kicks, and that store sells sneakers, the Triangle's new home base for sneakerheads. Let's hope that is still in, they're still in the business. For the unfamiliar, sneaker resale stores can be intimidating. Sometimes shoes are wrapped in plastic to protect them, and like in a museum, you're not sure if it's permissible to touch the goods. And, much like in a museum, there's an overwhelming abundance of sensorial pleasure. The colors, the styles, the artful display. These are not the racks at Foot Locker or Dick's, but rather a special place for shoe people, from the casual consumer purchasing a new pair of Pandas to the hype beast looking for the latest drop. Some pairs of shoes might cost half a paycheck or more. Others are less than what you'd pay at a sporting goods store. It's on you to know why. If you're a sneakerhead, you probably already know what you're looking for, but there's always the possibility of surprise, a shoe you didn't expect to find. Every sneaker store visit is an opportunity, not just to score, but to connect. That last bit I learned from Larry Antunez-Lopez and Michael Antunez-Lopez, the pair of brothers who own and operate Mad Kicks in downtown Durham, the first sneaker and streetwear shop to grace Main Street. There's no plastic wrap on the shoes at Mad Kicks, and customers can try everything on. This can be a big deal in sneaker stores, which have to worry about creases that devalue the product. Creating a welcoming brick-and-mortar space is important to the Antunez-Lopez brothers, who started the business 4 years ago in an unused corner of their mother's Herbalife Cafe on Roxborough Street. Larry, who is now 19, was too young at the time to file the paperwork to start his own business, so he asked Michael, his 4 years his senior, to be his partner. "He just texted me one day," Michael says, "and was like, 'Hey, what do you think of the name Mad Kicks?' And I was like, 'Yo, that's dope. I don't have mind for reselling. It was his idea. Our mom had this little 12x12 space she wasn't using, so I was like, let's open a sneaker store.'" At the time, Michael had recently graduated from Northern High and was already working, so he had some funds to invest, $1,000, to start the store. With help from their stepfather, a contractor, the teens installed walls and shelves in that Roxborough Street space. "We got the location down. Next step, inventory. We basically started off with two shoes." Larry, then 15 and a freshman at Durham School of the Arts, wasn't living at home and was having a tough time with quarantine. "I started this business because I wanted the Lakers sneaker, but also because it was another way to get out. You had to put a lot of effort for me to even show up to class, let alone when you did it online. I'm definitely not showing up to class," he adds. "But I knew that I didn't want to stay in that position forever. I've also had the drive at a young age, and I always knew I was going to be an entrepreneur somehow, some way. Even as a kid, before I even knew what the word entrepreneur was, I just knew that I was going to do something for myself, build something. Larry adds, we've always had a love for shoes. He's wearing an Off-White t-shirt, the brand founded by legendary designer Virgil Abloh. It's one of several streetwear brands the Downtown Shop resells, alongside other popular independent labels like Denim Tears, Essentials, Hellstar, Bape, and Supreme. But we didn't grow up in the nicest part of Durham, so that's always been a dream that, you know, a lot of kids have. Oh, I want the newest Jordans. But depending on where you grew up, you can't always have the latest Jordans. And he continues, I can't say that I was a sneakerhead when I started, because I was still wearing Vans or Converse, whatever my mom could buy. I didn't grab my first pair of sneakers till a couple of months after opening the store. It was my birthday, and I was like, okay, I have a sneaker store now. I might as well treat myself. Aside from that special pair of Jordan 5 Retro Metallic White, all the money the brothers make from buying and reselling went right back into the business as they slowly began to grow their inventory. While the first location was small, there was a mural inside the store the brothers painted with a friend that depicted downtown Durham. You saw the skyline, tower, the exact buildings. That's because every time we walked in, me and my brother had a goal. Our goal? We are where we wanted to be back then, but now we are here, downtown Durham. We've got new goals. By building up from just two pair, the Atunias Lopez brothers are, in their own way, replicating the ascent of streetwear globally, which came from the ground up, a cultural movement that started in the streets and has grown to influence, and sometimes even eclipse, high fashion. Well, folks, and that's about half that article, and I must stop reading the article at that point. You can still find it as all the past articles on IndieWeek.com. And our music tells me that I'm leaving you in 38 seconds. And for the North Carolina Reading Service, John Federson for Indie Week. Our studio is closed on Thanksgiving Day. I will not be recording the Indie Week then. Maybe I can get an alternative time. But do go to IndieWeek.com and check for yourself. You can replay articles from here on a podcast. Just go to ncreadingservice.com. And for now, so long. Have a good holiday.